Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, an argument for the biological foundations of human morality. Our guest is Franz de Waal. He is the author of a number of books, but the one that we're talking about today is The Bonobo and the Atheist in Search of Humanism Among the Primates. I'm going to ask Rhonda if we can put a picture of the front. We are. All right, she's on it. You got to see the cover of this book because you just have to see it. So go to our Facebook page and see the cover of this book and tell us what you think. It's an extraordinary picture. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show is the place to go. Our guest, we've talked to him many times before. He has been studying particularly bonobos, but primates for a long, long time. And he is a man who was born in Holland, in the Netherlands. He is a Dutch-American biologist who has written many, many books. He is professor at Emory University and director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center. He has written books about his studies, and they have been extensive. And the latest ones have been detecting the seeds of human nature in the behavior and actions of our primate relatives. He begins the book talking about a conference that he was part of a panel with the Dalai Lama, and he reviewed the latest evidence for animal altruism. Apes will voluntarily open a door to offer a companion access to food, even if they lose part of it in the process. Good deeds occur spontaneously. An old female peony spends her days outdoors with other chimps in the primate center's field stations. On bad days, when her arthritis is flaring up, she has trouble walking and climbing, but other females help her out, and they help her out in a significant way. These really captivate us, and he'll tell us such stories. But the book also looks at God and whether or not whether we do good comes from God, or is it something that is very much a part of us and we see it in our primate forebears. It's a fascinating book. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Franz de Waal. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and go to our Facebook page to see the cover of this book because it's wonderful. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Franz de Waal, thank you so much for joining us again. Hello.
I'm glad to be there.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us again. I love the stories in the book, but let's start with it, because I thought this was a fascinating conference you were a part of with the Dalai Lama. What was your, you were on a panel with the Dalai Lama. What was your mission to be on that panel?
Well, the Dalai Lama is interested in compassion, as you may know. And so, and actually he believes that that's a natural human characteristic, as I would also say. Even though he also believes, of course, that you can cultivate it and extend it and expand it and things like that. And so I was explaining all the experiments and observations of elephants and apes, of acts of empathy and sympathy. And there are many studies now of that particular topic. But in the middle of it, he interrupted me and he said, so what about turtles? Now, I think when I talk about empathy, I think it's very much a mammalian characteristic, and actually the reason we humans have mammals at home, mostly cats and dogs, is because we like that. We like animals that respond to our emotions, and we respond to their emotions, and that creates a bond between us. But with turtles, you know, I'm a big fish lover, for example. I have enormous tanks with lots of fish, and empathy is not exactly what I get from them. I get other things from them. So I tried to explain to him that an animal that doesn't have parental care, because the turtle just lays eggs and then disappears, and then those eggs have to hatch on their own. I said, if you don't have parental care, it's very hard to imagine how you would get the empathy mechanism in place, because we think in mammals it actually starts with maternal care. So a female, whether you're a mouse or an elephant, You need to take care of your offspring and react to their emotional signals when they're cold or when they're hungry or in danger. You need to respond right away, otherwise you're going to lose your offspring. So empathy has a very high survival value for mammals, for sure, but I think for turtles, zero. So we had that kind of discussion.
Yeah, it must have been a fascinating discussion. No doubt about that. So were you able to convince him that our sense of morality can come from within, and that by looking at primates particularly, which is what you have done, we can see a biological foundation of human morality rather than having it come from God?
Yeah, and actually the Dalai Lama has written a book, I believe. It's either something like Beyond Religion or A Call for Secular Ethics. I'm forgetting the title now, but he's very much on the same line, is that many of these characteristics come from within the human species. You don't necessarily need religion for it, even though, of course, he's not against religion. And actually, I'm not, in my book, as you may have noticed, I'm
yes.
not particularly against religion, even though I'm personally a non-believer. But I think religion probably has a place in the whole story. But it's not the prominent place that many people believe. So many people believe morality comes from God or from religion. And they equate the two almost, like religion and morality go together. But our current religions are only 2,000 or 3,000 years old, and our species is far older. And you're not going to tell me that 100,000 years ago our ancestors had no understanding of right and wrong, had no sense of fairness, did not punish certain individuals for certain behavior. All of that must have been going on. That's my assumption. And many of these tendencies that are built into our human morality are actually much older than that, and probably come from other primates.
There are a lot of the pictures of Hieronymus Bosch in this book, and evidently you were... What's your connection with him? You're fascinated by him, certainly, and I was, again, when I looked at these pictures, but you were born in a same area of the Netherlands, is that it?
Yeah, Bosch named himself... Hieronymus Bosch named himself after the city Den Bosch, which is the city where I was born.
Ah.
So that's my connection with him, and I've always been fascinated by him. And I know for many people he's a sort of morbid painter, but that's because all people get to see usually from him are the hell scenes. He has painted two hell scenes, and they are terrible. And so people see that, and they think, well, that's Bosch, but Bosch has painted a lot more than that. And so I use the Garden of Earthly Delights, which is his most famous painting that hangs in the Prado in Madrid. I use that painting to illustrate the changing views on morality of his days. He lived at the same time as Erasmus, who was a big humanist in the Netherlands. And so the Dutch have this long tradition of humanism that goes back to Erasmus and Spinoza and people like that. And Bosch was, as a painter, part of that, even though, of course, he could not say anything because he was saying everything with images. But he was depicting scenes like in the Garden of Earthly Delights, scenes of how humanity would look without the fall, for example. If we had no knowledge of right and wrong in religious terms, what would the world be like? And so I think he was trying to imagine what would the world be like with a reduced role of religion.
Mm-hmm. We always love to hear your remarkable observations of primates. So let me start by asking you, and there may be some who don't understand differences between chimpanzees and bonobos, but I was thinking as I heard these stories, why is it when we look at the issue of right and wrong and empathy, sympathy, even gratitude, why do bonobos seem to be much more moral than chimpanzees? And I guess... then I'm also asking, why is it that there are some humans who seem to be much more moral than other humans?
Well, the bonobos are nicer, let's say. That would be the short answer.
They're nicer.
they have less violence. For example, there are no observations in the field or in captivity of one bonobo killing another bonobo.
I know. I read that in your book. I said, my goodness, isn't that something?
And for chimpanzees, we have lots of that kind of observation.
Uh-huh.
Both in captivity and in the field. And so that's a substantial difference between the two. For example, if bonobo groups meet each other, there is some hostility, some limited hostility, but very soon they have sex with each other, and then they groom each other and they get along, which is in chimpanzees is really impossible. In chimpanzees, you only have different gradations of hostility between groups, and sometimes it gets extremely violent, and they kill each other. So the bonobo is a friendlier primate. I must say also that I don't equate necessarily morality with being nice. And so the reason we have moral systems is partly because we are not nice. If we were universally altruistic and nice with each other, there would be absolutely no need for a system of rules that we have in our moral systems. We would be perfectly fine that way. But the reason we have moral systems that distinguish between right and wrong is precisely because we have conflicts of interests going on in society. And so the chimpanzee is highly relevant in that regard, because the chimpanzee has more intense conflict, so to speak, than the bonobo. And the chimpanzee is a very power-hungry creature. And so you see these conflicts being played out in their society. And so I think both species are quite informative, so to speak, about our background. The bonobo on the side of empathy and sympathy, so to speak, and the chimpanzee on the side of how do you work out conflicts, because they still maintain an operational society. Mm.
But you've suggested, haven't you, that our closest relative may be the bonobo.
Yeah, we know now that that's not entirely possible, because genetically the bonobo and the chimpanzee are exactly equally close to us, which is very close, in fact. The DNA of them is 98.5% identical to human DNA. And the only question we can have is the last common ancestor that is at the root of our evolution and their evolution, so to speak. What kind of creature was that? And we really don't know. It could have been a gorilla-like animal, could have been chimpanzee-like or bonobo-like. Those are the African apes that we know that still exists. It's definitely an African ape. It's not going to be like an orangutan, which is an Asian ape. And so it's one of these three species, or maybe something totally different that is related to them.
Mm-hmm. Is it highly unusual? You mentioned that bonobos, which I found very striking, have not killed each other. Certainly humans can't say the same. I'm wondering if there are many mammals on Earth that don't kill each other.
Yeah, I don't know. I've no idea. There's some speculation that all animals, if you watch them long enough, there will be a case of lethal aggression. People have claimed that. And maybe with the bonobo, we have watched them now for a couple of decades quite intensely. Who knows? But it may still happen with bonobos.
Mm-hmm.
So I would not completely rule it out.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about how you've been able to observe, and you've done this for such a long period of time, how you've been able to observe primates.
Well, I've mostly worked at primate centers. I actually worked for 10 years in Wisconsin in Madison at the primate center.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I actually did quite a bit of work at the San Diego Zoo just to escape your winters. So I've studied mostly in captivity. I have some students and postdocs who work in the field, work with elephants in the field or with bonobos in the field. But most of the work that we do is in captivity because it affords more detailed observations, which I need for my kind of work, and it affords also experimentation. So at the moment, for example, we have about 30 chimpanzees at the Yerkes Field Station here in Georgia, and these animals live in outdoor compounds, but they know their names, and we call them by name into a building. And so it's all on a volunteer basis. We open the building and they come in, and then we do certain tests. So, for example, one of the tests that we recently did with chimpanzees is we see if they're pro-social. Do they care about the well-being of others? So we set up a test where they can select between two different colored tokens. If they pick one color, it only rewards themselves. They have to exchange it with us and give it to us, and then they get food for themselves. The other token, the other color, will reward themselves plus their partner who is sitting next to them. So the only, for them, it makes no difference. They get rewarded regardless of what they pick. The only difference is, does my partner get something, yes or no? And they, over time, when they do this many times, they develop a preference for the token that gives food to both of them, which indicates that they do care about the well-being of somebody else.
Why should they? Why would they?
Well, I think that's a general tendency in social animals, social mammals at least, is that if you live in a society, you depend on that society. A primate, also a human, is barely capable of surviving on its own without companions. And so group life is awfully important to them, both in a general sense that you need to live in a group to survive, but also in more specific sense that you hunt together or you call each other when there's a predator around and things like that. So there's some specific benefits that they give each other. And in that context, you need to take care of each other. If you survive together, you need to watch each other, and you need to support each other. And so, for example, chimpanzees in the field, they support each other against predators like leopards, which is a very risky affair. And so if one of them gets attacked by a leopard, others will hear the screaming and go over and chase the leopard off.
Hmm.
And so if you live in a group and you survive in a group, you do need some level of solidarity. Otherwise, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's where these tendencies come from.
There also, and this came, I believe, from the Milwaukee County Zoo, where the studies that you have done show that apes can feel guilt and shame. This was a bonobo in the Milwaukee County Zoo who bit the hand. It was an accident of a veterinarian who was feeding him vitamin pills. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, this was Lodi. I'm not sure that Lodi is still alive. He's a male at the Milwaukee County Zoo. And he was being fed vitamins by the veterinarian, and all of a sudden he grabbed the hand and bit the finger off of the veterinarian.
Ooh, ah.
Well, bonobos and chimpanzees, they're both they're far stronger than you can imagine, and biting a finger off is really something that they can very quickly happen with them. And so he did that, and he was sort of, it seemed like, astonished by what had happened. And they tried to reattach the finger to the vet. They got the finger back from him. They tried to reattach it, but it didn't succeed. And so the next day, the veterinarian, or next week, whatever, a few days later, the veterinarian approached Lodi, who was sitting behind the glass in his enclosure, and showed her hand with the bandage to him. And he immediately ran to the furthest corner and sat in a sort of huddled position. Which look, you know, we humans, we say when we are ashamed, like, I want to sink into the ground, I want to disappear. Well, that's a bit how he probably looked. And then she visited, she left her position, and she visited 15 years later, I believe, and was standing in front of the enclosure, and Lodi immediately came up to her. And her hands were not visible because they were sort of under the railing.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept insisting that he wanted to see her left hand. He kept looking at her face. And he wanted to see that hand, and she held it up with the missing finger. He looked between her hand and her face multiple times, and she had clearly the impression that he, after 15 years, he still knew what he had done. So that kind of incidents gives the impression that they have a very good memory.
Yes.
for that kind of damaging behavior that we sometimes show, we humans. And I've seen bonobos among themselves, so this is with a human, but I've also seen among themselves that if there's a fight and one of them makes a scratch or bites a leg or something like that, so makes some small injury, that they remember that very well, and that when they then reconcile afterwards, they immediately go to that spot and start inspecting and licking it. And so it's not like they need to think about, where did I bite? No, they know the specific location where they put their teeth.
Those stories just are astounding to me. And you, of course, have, I'm sure, more than your share, having observed primates so closely. You've had primates recognize you, haven't you, when you haven't seen them for years and years?
Yeah, that happens. I was just recently in the Netherlands and was greeted again by the old females that still know me from more than 30 years ago there. But also but those females have still seen me intermittently now and then that I visit that zoo. But recently I had a case where I visited a chimp haven in Louisiana where they had a female that I had not seen for 20 years. She didn't recognize me because I had a mask on, but when I started talking, she immediately greeted me and recognized me. And so, yeah, they have a very good memory. Just like humans, we have a very good memory, I think, for faces.
Mm-hmm. Is what you have to say in the scientific community rather unusual, or would you say that most people who are considered great primatologists are observing what you're observing as well? Or are you saying things that are brand new?
Well, the word empathy was not used for sure in primatology until I started doing that in the 90s. And at that time, there was resistance to it. Many people felt that kind of terminology for animals was not appropriate. Now there are papers in Science and Nature on empathy in rodents, in rats and mice, certainly on elephants and dogs and other mammals. And I think we have reached the point now that everyone understands that when we say that animals have empathy, we don't necessarily mean the highest level where I imagine how you would feel under X circumstances, because that imagination process is probably not present in rodents, and maybe not even present in your average dog, you know. So everyone understands that what we mean by empathy is a sensitivity to the emotions of others, responding to the emotions, adopting the same emotions. So for example, adopting fear when someone else is fearful. And so everyone now starts to understand that empathy has many different levels, and that some of these levels are complex and may be present only in apes and humans, but other levels are fairly widespread. And I think that idea is becoming pretty much established now.
Mm-hmm. And in your observation of primates, what happens when one of the members of the community goes haywire and does something that's not beneficial to the community and may harm the community?
Yeah, the primates do respond to that, and they do show what I call community concern. So what I mean by that is that you're not just interested in your own relations, or, for example, I will punish you when I'm the dominant and you're subordinate and you take my food, I may punish you. That's basically in my own interest. But they also show actions that are in the community's interest. And so, for example, two typical ones are females who mediate in conflicts between males. So, for example, two males have a big fight. They sit opposite each other. They don't reconcile. An older female, it's usually older females who do this, she goes to one of those males and grabs him by the arm and makes him move towards the other. And then when those two are together and are grooming, then she walks away. And so she has sort of fixed a problem that existed in the community. Another very common one is high-ranking males who break up fights. So let's say two females are fighting and screaming at each other, and a high-ranking male will go over and stand between them with all his hair on end and very intimidating until the screaming stops, and so he stops a fight. And so those are actions that are not necessarily in the individual's interest. That male could also just let these females fight. When, you know, who cares? Or the female who mediates, he could just let these males sit and let them work it out by themselves. But they step in and they fix a problem in the community. And actually, it's a very important that policing by high-ranking males is very important, because we did an experiment one time where this was on monkeys, where we removed high-ranking males for just one day at a time. Mm. And then at the end of the day, we would put them back in. And during that day that they were absent, and so that there was no one to police all the conflicts in the group, it became a big mess. And so the conflicts escalated, reconciliations disappeared, play behavior, which is a good indicator of how relaxed they are, disappeared. And so without animals doing this kind of thing, actually the cooperative life falls apart.
Hmm, fascinating. And for the bonobos, it's the females who do that, right, who can stop the males from fighting?
The females are dominant in the bonobos. They're collectively dominant. They're not necessarily individually dominant. And if, for example, at a zoo, I don't think it exists anymore, but there used to be zoos who had just one male and one female. In that case, the male is dominant in bonobos.
Mm.
As soon as you have two females, the females are dominant. And so the females have a very high level of solidarity. They form these alliances that they have, and they dominate the males. And it's the females who run most of the show in bonobos. And so if there's, for example, a fight, they support males, and their sons usually benefit from female support. So high-ranking females tend to have high-ranking sons because they support them against other males.
Frans de Waal is our guest this hour. His latest book is The Bonobo and the Atheist. He is a biologist who has been named, actually, among Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People. He's the author of a number of books. We've interviewed him on many of his other books. And this one looks at a huge issue, actually. It, as I've said, it makes an argument for the biological foundations of human morality. And he finds this from many very close scientific observations of chimps and apes and bonobos over a long period of time. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to use that, where you can also find a picture that is the cover picture of his book, and I urge you to look at it. It's one of those pictures you can just look at for an hour, if not longer. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We welcome your phone calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we'll be talking about Jackie Robinson. Today is Jackie Robinson Day. It was 66 years ago today that Jackie Robinson made his appearance with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And today there's a huge celebration going on in Los Angeles. And the movie came out on Friday, so I hope some of you will have had a chance to see 42, the movie that was just released. We will be speaking tomorrow with Mr. James Beckham, who is a former Negro League player and has started a wonderful baseball program for Central City youngsters. And it's here in downtown Milwaukee. He's just a spectacular man. He also was honored by being able to throw out the first pitch at opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers this year. He'll be with us, and Scott Simon will also join us. Scott, of course, does the marvelous show on Saturday mornings on National Public Radio and has been with NPR for years. Some years ago, he wrote a book on Jackie Robinson, and we'll talk about that, Jackie Robinson and the integration of baseball. All right, let's go to phone calls for Frans de Waal, and we start with Vicki in Manitowoc. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I'm so happy to congratulate your guest. I remember when we learned from Diane Fossey about the gorillas, Jane Goodall's pioneering work with, I guess, apes, and the things that those of us who have loved animals have intuited for generations. And it's so wonderful that his work is documented and legal and has got the blessings, you know, of his long years of work. But I think that it greatly thrills me to have it acknowledged.
Thank you. Yeah, you have a question also?
Well, my question would be, where do you go next now that you have begun to have acceptance and you must have peers among you also? What is your next challenge to expand your work?
Well, we keep doing the same line of work, of course, on chimpanzees mostly, but we also do studies on bonobos at the moment at a sanctuary. But my hope is that there will be a next generation, and there is actually a next generation working on this kind of topics, who is going to delve deeper into it. So, for example, I may establish that empathy exists in certain animals like the primates or elephants, but there's many questions about it, because even though empathy is a sort of automated response to the emotions of others, we don't always react to it. You know how humans are, for example, also. We may feel sorry for a certain person under certain circumstances, but then we walk on or we drive on and we let them alone. And the same thing happens, of course, in animals. And so the regulation of how you use that capacity and under which circumstances does it translate into helping behavior and how you inhibit responses and so on, that whole part, the details of it, are really unknown at the moment. And I think that's the sort of research that we need at this point.
Hmm. Thank you for your work.
Thank you, Vicki, so much for your call. Our number, 800-486. I've mentioned the cover picture several times. Can you tell me who this is?
The cover picture was made by a woman, Marianne Brickner, who took pictures at the time at the Cincinnati Zoo, where they have bonobos. And at that point, there was a three-year-old bonobo named Vic who lived in the group. And there was a man who would bring his son every week to play with Vic. The son was the same age, 3 years old, and they would play through the glass because Vic was in its enclosure behind glass. And so the picture is also taken through the glass, because it almost seems as if it's real contact, but there is glass between them. And those two became very good friends. And Vic is now 12 years old, and so the book also includes a picture of how he looks now, which is, of course, he's now almost adult.
That's a great story. It's just such a remarkable picture, I think. And now that I know the story behind it, it's even more remarkable. Willem is our next caller in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi, good morning. I heard a story on the BBC this weekend about an ape. I don't remember it wasn't a chimpanzee or gorilla or anything. And they were talking about it making sounds like human speech, like it moved its jaw and its mouth in the same way that people do when they speak, and the sounds were—it was kind of comical. And I was wondering if chimpanzees have or bonobos have a speech. But this was actually like they played the sound. It was really interesting. It was like talking. It sounded like people making a funny sound.
Well, it's unusual because as opposed to many birds. The primates are very poor at vocal imitation, so they can do some limited amount. There are some suggestions that they sometimes, if they're raised by humans, that they try to imitate the sounds, and you need a lot of imagination to hear the words that people say they are saying, and so they're usually not very good at imitation, and there's one report of an elephant who imitates human sounds, and there's one report of, I think it's a sea lion who does. And so if you look those up on YouTube, you'll probably get the videos of it. But the apes are generally not very good at this.
Anything else, Willem?
No, that was just, I would just wish I could remember the name of the ape, because it really was like, not like grunting sounds, but like, it was kind of a sound.
Oh, this is maybe the report on gelada baboons that came out. Gelada baboons have a lot of contact calls, and they sound sometimes human-like. Of course, they're not imitations of humans. They are just their own contact calls, and the precise meaning of every little call is probably not known to us, but it is the sort of noises that they make when they move over the grass. They live in Ethiopia, they eat a lot of grass, and they shuffle around in it. And while they're doing that, they're making an enormous amount of little contact calls with each other. That's what you saw.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Thanks, Willem, for the call. Here's an email that's come in from Carol in Wisconsin Rapids. We recently viewed a program regarding cloning of its extinct animals, in this case an attempt to clone a woolly mammoth. I have mixed feelings about this issue. I wonder if Franz could comment on cloning of animals in general and perhaps also touch on cloning extinct critters.
Yeah, that's a big question, is that if we could, for example, revive the dodo or something, or the mammoth, the thing is that many of these animals are extinct for a reason, is that they were hunted probably to extinction by us. And so if we revive them and restock them, we need to make sure that we are not, that we're not 20 years later collecting the ivory of the mammoth that we have created. Because who knows, that may happen then. And then it would be all for nothing that we did this. So I think there are some ethical questions, but on the other hand, we as scientists, we are, of course, very curious to see mammoths and see how they behave and what they do. And if we could well protect them, it would be a magnificent animal to get back on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your email. Let's hear some more stories, and this one, I believe, is points to empathy. You're saying that you're convinced apes can take the perspective of others. This is a story early on in the book about one of the handsomest males you have ever known, Amos.
Yeah, so Amos was a male who died relatively young here at the Yerkes Primate Center, and he he had an enlarged liver, and so at some point we had to put him down because there was no way of rescuing him. But on the day that he got sick, all of a sudden, he was sweating and breathing very heavily, and it was very clear that he was very, very ill. He was not eating for sure. And so we let all the other chimps out, but we put him in a sort of small room, but you cracked the door open so that others had access to him. And there was a female named Daisy, who is a friend of Amos, who groomed him and sort of stayed with him through the crack of the door. And at some point, she collected a lot of wood wool, which the chimps used to sleep in. But they built nests out of it. And Daisy herself, actually, is a very big collector of that kind of stuff. And so she collected it, but she started pushing it through the crack of the door to him, towards him. And when he, because he was really sick, when he didn't really respond much, she started stuffing that stuff behind his back, between his back and the wall. And it looked very much superficially as the way people arrange the pillows behind a sick person in the hospital, and then have them lean back in it, as if Daisy had some sort of understanding of what would make Amos comfortable, which would be the wood wool, and so she was arranging that for him. And for me, it was an interesting event because I'm interested in perspective taking, because if empathy, the emotional part of empathy, is combined with that you take the perspective of somebody else, it gets much richer, as it is in humans. And so then you put yourself really in the shoes of somebody else, and that's what Daisy seemed to be doing. Like, if I were in his circumstances, I would want to be able to lean against wood wool or something.
Was this a unique observation, or have you seen it subquently?
No, these are just anecdotes of what we see. We have seen other events of helping. You mentioned at the beginning we had Penny, an old female, that they would push up because she could barely walk anymore. They would push her up into the climbing frame.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so these are anecdotals, but there is now actually an experiment. So I usually like to collect these stories. But the ultimate test is very often a controlled experiment. And this was done in Japan, where they had an experiment where one chimpanzee had seven tools to choose from, and the other chimpanzee placed next to it, had a situation where she needed one very specific tool to collect her food. And so the first chimpanzee, who had all the tools available, needed to look at the situation of the second one to see what kind of tool was needed in that situation, and then pick out a tool and hand it to the other one, and then the other one was able to use it to get some food. And so there's two elements to it. One is that the first one needs to be willing to help, but also that the first one needs to judge the situation of the other, which is perspective taking. And they did that. The chimpanzees did that. And so there is now finally an experiment on some of these capacities that I often mention.
We go to John in Madison next. Hi, John.
Hi. Gwen Dyer, the famous military historian, wrote a book called War, the Lethal Custom, an incredible book. And in it, he raises the question of whether chimps and humans share a genetically programmed territorial aggression. Both chimps and human societies that are still in hunter-gatherer formations, such as found in the Amazon basin and New Guinea, in both, they appear to spontaneously patrol the periphery of their forage area and kill either humans or other chimps. And in chimps and in these primitive human groups, 25% of the males lose their lives due to this. It's a kind of a scary scenario, because I read the head chimp will just spontaneously get the other chimps, and they'll patrol this 5-mile circumference, and if they find other chimps in it, they'll automatically kill them. And I just wondered if the bonobos show any evidence of this.
Yeah, there's actually quite a bit of controversy around this kind of data. That chimpanzees do this is well established. So I think all the chimpanzees, including chimpanzees that are not provisioned by humans, because initially when Jane Goodall reported this, people said, well, it's because she's feeding bananas and that must have triggered lots of aggression and stuff like that. But there are now observations of chimpanzee communities that are not provisioned by humans, and they're still doing this kind of stuff. So I think for chimpanzees, this is pretty well established. For humans, there's a bit of a controversy in the sense that some anthropologists don't agree with the data on the hunter-gatherers and say it's a sort of a cherry-picking of violence data, and that there's a lot of hunter-gatherer groups that most of the time don't wage war at all. And also they claim that the evidence for warfare in our lineage is only like 10 or 12,000 years old. And from before that time, so that coincides with the agricultural revolution. And before that time, we may not have been waging war very much. And so there's this kind of controversy. As far as the bonobos are concerned, the bonobos are exactly equally close to us as the chimps and don't do any of this. So bonobos, the groups meet. There's never an incident of violent aggression. I've seen videos, actually, of field workers seeing males playing with juveniles from a different group and being very relaxed about it, and so that something that's impossible in the chimpanzee because the males are totally violent when they meet members of a different group. And so the bonobo, even though the bonobo is exactly equally close to us, doesn't tell this story at all. And so there is quite a bit of debate about how much of a, let's say, territorial instinct we have and how strong that is.
Thank you very much for the call. You spend time in the book talking about, and I've often thought about this in human beings, the most altruistic act of all, and that's mothering. Mm-hmm. I mean, it goes on for a long, long, long period of time, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this has been a bit overlooked. When biologists talk about altruism, they like to call it the puzzle of altruism. And what they mean is that, why would I do something for somebody else? Why would I just not think about my own survival? And who cares about the survival of somebody else? And in that whole debate, they have been overlooking the most basic form of altruism, which is maternal care.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because for the biologist, that's not a puzzle at all. That a female takes care of her own offspring is something that we can very easily explain. That's, of course, a characteristic that carried on and that gave benefits for your reproduction and so on. So we have no trouble explaining it at all. And so they sort of pushed it to the side because it was not a puzzle. But in the end, the people who work on empathy, not just me in animals, but also scientists who work on empathy in humans, we assume that maternal care in the mammals is the origin of empathic tendencies, is that it's all started with that. And that explains two things. That explains why females have more empathy than males, and this is universally so in humans, and this has now also been found in many of the animal studies. And secondly, why oxytocin, which is a maternal hormone, basically, if you spray that in the nostrils of humans, men and women, you get more empathic reactions from them. And so oxytocin is very much involved in the empathy mechanism. So maternal care has been overlooked, even though it may be the basis of all of it.
Frans de Waal is our guest this hour. His latest book is The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. He's a biology professor at Emory University, director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes Primate Center in Atlanta. Although he has done his work all over the world, he is a Dutch citizen as well. He's recognized as one of the world's top experts on primatology, especially chimpanzees and more especially the bonobos and apes as well. He has reached some very basic conclusions, which is the subject of the book. Chimps and bonobos and other primates clearly show empathy with others who are suffering. They have a sense of fairness. They take care of those in need, and they will share what they have with others who are less fortunate. So the book, as the title will suggest, is an argument for the biological foundations of human morality. Here's how you reach us. We have a couple lines open for you, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where you can see a picture of the bonobo and his friend, and they were friends. That's a great story. Once a week for many, many years. They're both now 12. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number again, if you'd like to join the conversation with Franz DeWall, is 800-486-8655. Wayne in Brown Deer is next. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning. I wonder if any evidence has been shown of mental illness in the bonobos or other primates.
Yeah, there's a bit of a problem. Sometimes people wonder if they have autism, for example, or schizophrenia. We work with very small sample sizes, so I worked with basically 25 or 30 chimpanzees, and of course, if you, for example, psychopaths in humans is, what is it, 1% or 2%, so the chance of having one is not so great, and in general, it's very hard to determine that, and so people sometimes claim this kind of patterns in the primates, and it's very well possible that they exist. But to find hard evidence is a bit difficult. We did have one time a trisomic chimpanzee here at the Yerkes Primate Center. So that was closer to Down syndrome or something like that. And that was sort of visible in the chimpanzee. So many of the afflictions of humans you can find. And sometimes the evidence is stronger than in other cases. But for something like, let's say, autism, what kind of evidence would we need to produce? Imagine we have one that resembles that. What kind of evidence would you need to be convinced that it is autism? That's going to be really difficult.
Thanks, Wayne. John in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hey, seeing if you can relate all this to culture in humans and the great apes, and if you could touch on theory of mind quick. Thanks.
Theory of what?
Theory of mind.
Theory of mind, okay.
Well, theory of mind is a term that is very similar to what I say when I say perspective taking, and so we discussed how Daisy was probably taking the perspective of Amos, and we discussed targeted helping, where one chimpanzee needs to understand what kind of tools the other chimpanzee will need. And so all of that relates closely to what is sometimes called theory of mind, even though that term is not my favorite term to describe it. So, but perspective taking, I think, comes in with large-brained animals like elephants and dolphins and apes, and we think it actually correlates with mirror self-recognition. So the animals who recognize themselves in the mirror are going to be stronger at this. And we did an experiment on elephants a couple of years ago, because elephants were the one species that was left out of these studies, and they had failed the mirror test. And so we did the mirror test on elephants, and at the moment, Josh Plotnick, who works with me on elephants in Thailand, has a lot of evidence for mirror self-recognition in the elephants.
Thanks. Tom is next in Burlington. Hi.
Dr. Oz was saying that the human beings have a G-spot in their mouth, and I wonder, have you guys looked at that as far as mammals having a pleasure spot in their mouth?
Wow, no, I don't know anything about it. I didn't even know about it for humans in the mouth. I have no idea about that, and I'm not sure how we would find it out. We haven't really worked on that, no.
How... I want to talk just a little bit about bonobos, because as I was reading the book, I was wondering where they still live. Are there still many bonobos, just a few bonobos? Is anybody studying them in the wild?
Yeah, the bonobos live only in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is a sort of war zone, has been a war zone since the early 90s. I think 5 million people were killed there.
Mm.
And at the moment, there's still a lot of war going on in the eastern part of the country. It's a very big country. The country is as big as the United States east from the Mississippi. So Wisconsin would fall under that.
Mm-hmm.
It's an enormous surface, and we don't always see that because our projections don't do a lot of credit to Africa. So in that enormous country, the bonobos live, and they live nowhere else.
Mm.
And we used to think that there might be 100,000 bonobos because it's very dense forest and quite inaccessible and so on. But at the moment, the estimates are much lower.
Mm.
So, for example, Gay Reinhardt, who works at the Milwaukee Zoo, she's very much involved in these conservation efforts. And you would have to ask her, but I bet she would come up as between 5 and 10,000.
Hmm. We will ask her. We haven't had her on in a long time. We're plumb out of time. I could talk to you all day. Frans de Waal, we thank you very much for being with us. The book is The Bonobo and the Atheist in Search of Humanism Among the Primates. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for all of the production of this show.